Okay.
All right, part two. So what I talked about last time, as you remember, was adaptation in these purely asexual E. coli populations from Rich Lenski's long-term evolution experiment. So what I'm going to talk about today, at least to begin with, in the first part of the second part, is experiments that we did in budding yeast to look at similar sorts of dynamics in sexual populations and compare these sexual populations of yeast with asexual populations and look at how the evolution differs. And I sort of shortened up slides from before, so hopefully I can get through both parts without going to some ridiculous amount of time. But I can go into more detail in any part when you guys ask questions. So I just wanted to give just an extremely brief overview of the theoretical idea that underlies our mathematical models of these effects in sexual populations. So like I mentioned last time, when you have selection acting on lots of different sites across the genome simultaneously, when recombination occurs, it can reassort mutations. But of course, on short distance scales within a genome, recombination is going to be rare. And so even, you know, obligately sexual organisms are going to experience the effects of interference selection on these short genomic distance scales. And the question is going to then become how frequent recombination is relative to the density of selected sites and compared to the relevant time scales for things to happen. And so we've been doing a bunch of theoretical work on this, and you know, Boris's group, among others, have also been working on this. And the basic idea behind all these models is you imagine some, you know, linear chromosome in some organism, and if we think about sites in the genome that are very, very far apart, such that the recombination rate times the time to the most recent common ancestor of a sample of individuals from that population is large, then basically, if you compare, if you sequence individuals from this population and you look at these sites that are far apart, the ancestors, you know, in the time that it took for those individuals to have a common ancestor, there will have been many recombination events between these two sites, and they'll be essentially freely recombining. And then on short distance scales, there will not have been any recombination events between these two sites. And so these sites will be effectively asexual. And so the way that we can think about this evolution is essentially in terms of these loosely defined linkage blocks, where regions that are short compared to this scale evolve essentially asexually, according to all of the asexual dynamics I was talking about last time. And then different linkage blocks are basically independent from one another. And this is the sort of crude idea behind this theory. And if anybody is interested afterwards, I'm happy to talk in person one-on-one about the theory that we're developing here. This is obviously a very crude approximation, and there's lots of problems with it, and we're still trying to work out various things using this approximation. It's certainly not complete. But anyway, that's the theory behind this. But what I want to spend time talking about today is the experiments. So we do these experiments in budding yeast. It's basically the exact same idea as Rich Lenski's experiments. So it's all batch culture in yeast. And like I mentioned in response to Shelley's question from yesterday, we are going to do these experiments over much, much shorter timescales for obvious practical reasons than Rich's experiment. But the trade-off is that we do many, many thousands, typically, of replicate populations. Although, for at least the first little bit of what I'm going to tell you next, with the sexual populations, the number of populations that we actually have good sequence data from is still pretty small. So we have this experimental evolution. And like I said, for at least the past dozen years or so, I've been trying to use evolution in yeast to compare sexual and asexual populations. And every time that I've tried to do it, I've spent like a year doing experiments and trying to get it to work. And at the end, it's been a complete failure because I find that the sexual populations have not actually had any sex. And the problem is that there's selection on ploidy. There's selection on loss of function mutations in the mating pathway or the sporulation pathway. So if you try to maintain populations as haploid, they lose the ability to mate. And if you try to maintain them as diploids, they lose the ability to sporulate. And so what you need is selection to maintain all of the relevant aspects of the mating pathway, and selection to force the cells to sporulate and mate on demand, so that they don't, you know, so that you can overcome the selection pressures that are also acting directly on ploidy. And so basically this is a scheme. It's sort of loosely based on Charlie Boone's magic marker system, for those of you that know that, but it's got a few more bells and whistles, that were developed by Mike McDowell. And basically it involves various ways to aggressively kill the yeast if they don't have sex exactly as you tell them to. And so this is a fancy slide intended to impress you with all of the details. Hopefully it's having its desired effect. But the basic idea here is just that we maintain these populations asexually, so for most of the time, and then we occasionally send them through these sporulation cycles. And so in one set of populations that I'm going to tell you about, what we do is we maintain the A and the alpha haploid populations separately. So these are in different wells of our plate for 90 generations at a time. And then we bring them together, we mate them, we force them to become diploids. Then we sporulate them, and we separate the pools, and we select one pool for the A and one pool for the alpha. And then you do another 90 generations of asexual evolution, okay, with the two mating types separately, and then you put them back together again. And we just repeat this again and again. Obviously, you can tune this number to tune the effective recombination rate, but what I'm going to tell you about is just the experiments, the first experiments we did, where this was always 90 generations. Yeah, Boris.
So is there also selection against diploids after sporulation? So this
that's right.
Presumably will
outgrow. When I say selection for A haploids, that means that these media will kill anything for alpha here, this will kill both A cells and diploids.
And that can be done with great efficiency.
Yeah, pretty damn good efficiency. So the best selection is for the diploids and against the haploids, because you have the double drug. So that basically has zero leakage. This can have tiny bits of leakage. We sort of monitored it very carefully through the experiment, and we kept it below like 0.1%.
But to do this, you have some negative selection markers.
Yes.
And then of course these guys are under selective pressure to get rid of them.
Yes. So right. So the key thing is, right, what we do is we have A and alpha specific promoters, okay, so that's this mating factor A and mating factor alpha promoters that drive nutrient markers. And we have this sterol 5 promoter, which is a haploid specific promoter, which drives this uro, which is counter selectable, trip, which is counter selectable. And then another key aspect of this, and this was the biggest pain in the ass, is we put these drug markers right next to the mating locus. Because otherwise what you will have is, you know, you'll get, if they're not linked tightly to the mating locus, you'll get recombination between the mating locus and these things. But this way you always have your A cell linked to CAN and your alpha cell linked to hygromycin. And that is very difficult for the cells to get around. You can get, like, you can imagine that a diploid will get a gene conversion event here or something, and so that's something we have to be careful for, but we can test for those things, because unless you get a gene conversion event and one of these other things switching at the same time, so it worked. I mean, I wouldn't guarantee it would work for 60,000 generations, but for 1,000 it's fine.
And presumably if it did happen and you looked at the time trace, you would see it as some crazy runaway.
Oh yeah, you would definitely see that. And you know, we can do FACS for DNA content and so on to ensure that, right. Okay, and you know, we have exactly the same idea for populations that we maintained as diploids, 90 generations as a diploid, then sporulation and mating, and then 90 generations.
So what would they do if you didn't kill them? Wouldn't they sporulate anyway?
No. They would, before too long, get mutations in genes that prevent them from, that then, in the presence of those mutations, prevents them from sporulating, and they would just live it happily as diploids. But when you put these things in sporulation media, in order to sporulate, they basically have to, like, arrest the cell cycle. It takes them a long time to do this, and the diploids would just keep dividing, and so they would just take the hell over. Not to mention the fact that, at least in these conditions, diploids typically have a fitness advantage over haploids, and so in the vegetative parts of the cell cycle, they would also tend to increase. But basically, the problem is that, like, if you look through the whole thing, even though you're getting some amount of sporulation, the vast majority of cells that make it through the sporulation cycle will never have had sex.
Well, that's the bit I haven't got. So sporulation is the meiosis part.
Yeah. They just won't sporulate, basically.
Okay, but you just said the ones that get through the sporulation, so...
They'll get through the sporulation cycle without sporulating. That's what I mean to say. That's what happens. Okay.
Well, but you may say that if that happens, if some sporulation happens, it just sort of reduces the effective rate of recombination.
But what we would like to do is control it, basically. So you could imagine doing experiments here where you tune the rate of recombination also by just setting how many, but this gives us control.
You don't need them to be sort of real obligate sexual, right? If they do it half the time, that's probably good enough, right?
Right. But you don't want it to be 0% of the time. And if you don't control it, it'll be effectively zero. Yeah. That's all I'm saying. All right. So what do we get? So we did this for 1,000 generations or so. And right now, so far, we only have a small number of lines that we've really characterized well. We're working to increase that right now. But what we get is in the populations maintained primarily in the haploid state, this is how much the populations increase in fitness. On average, these are a half a dozen different populations over the course of 1,000 generations of adaptation in the asexual and the sexual populations, and here are the diploid lines. So you see that in both cases, the sexual populations adapt much more rapidly than the asexual ones, which is, of course, what many years of population genetic theory would tell you. So that effect, that basic effect, of course, has been seen before.
Fitness is some measure of exponential growth rate?
No, so fitness is measured in exactly the same way that I talked about last time. Yeah, so it's just change in frequency over complete cycles, right, divided by the number of generations between cycles. So then we did the exact same kind of sequencing that I talked about last time. So this is 1,000 generations here, and we have about a dozen or so time points, I think 13 time points in each of these time courses. And here are two sort of representative asexual populations at the left and two representative sexual populations at the right. These are all populations that are maintained in the haploid state. And so what we're seeing here at each time point is the average frequency of an allele between the A and the alpha subpopulations. And there's a little bit of subtlety in these things because, a mutation first arises in one or the other subpopulation, and so you can see it like, okay, it'll increase in frequency in the A subpopulation, then there'll be sex, and then in the next cycle you'll see it coming up in the alpha subpopulation. And after a cycle or two, then it'll be more or less the same frequency in the two subpopulations. But there's a little bit of funkiness at the right at the beginning, which, if you think about it, can lead to a little bit of funkiness in these dynamics. But it's the basic idea is that these populations, the mutations can recombine. It sort of can take two cycles for that to happen. And so if you just look at these things, they look totally different, obviously. So in the asexual populations, you see these sweeps, you see these clonal interference effects. Oh, I should just say, these solid lines are non-synonymous mutations in coding regions. The dotted lines are intergenic mutations. These dashed lines, the dotted lines are synonymous, and the dashed lines are intergenic mutations. So, you get these various clonal interference effects, similar to before. You get these fixations of these clusters of mutations like we saw before. And then in the sexual populations, if you look at it, to me, this just looks like a big mess. And the reason it looks like a big mess is that there's a bunch of lines that aren't really tracking together in any way. They're just all doing their own thing, and so that's why it looks like a big mess. So this is exactly the effect that we expect sex to have. It just means that it just ensures that the changes in frequency of each mutation are at least more decoupled from each other, more independent of each other than in the sexual populations. And over lunch yesterday, you know, I flashed up this slide very briefly last time, and over lunch somebody said, well, it's not obvious that there's a big difference. So I don't want to dwell on this really, but you can actually just do a variety of different kinds of analysis of the difference between these two things across all the populations that we have. And you know, one simple thing to look at is how correlated the frequency changes are between all possible pairs of mutations at all possible time points. So basically what you do is, you know, you look at two successive time points, you look at the change in frequency of each mutation, and you look at the correlations between those, and that there's some distribution of those correlations. And what you see is that this distribution of correlations, in orange is the sexual, in blue is the asexual population. So the sexual populations are just basically much less correlated than the asexual ones. Okay? And this is a QQ plot illustrating the same thing. The sexual ones, they're a little bit more correlated than you would expect from the null, which also makes sense, but it's dramatically different from the asexual populations. Okay, that's just a way of quantifying what hopefully is obvious just from looking at this. All right, so we see that the sexual populations adapt more rapidly, and I'm just focusing on these haploid populations for the moment, because the diploid populations are a bit more of a mess. I'll show you briefly in a minute, but we see that they adapt faster. We see that there seems to be much less interference between mutations. So one thing we wanted to do was now see if we could explicitly identify the fitness effects of individual mutations and show how sex is allowing you to get the good mutations and get rid of the bad mutations. And so we did a sort of version of a bulk segregant analysis. So this is a slide I just sort of ripped off this figure from this paper out of Lee and Krugliak's group. Basically, what we did is we took one of our evolved lines, you made it to an ancestor, so you create a heterozygous diploid, you sporulate it, and we create a bunch of recombinants. Okay? And so then we sequence this pool, okay? So we sequence, and you know, we should have roughly 50%, in this pool, we should have roughly 50% frequency of every mutation that was present in the evolved haploid. And then we maintain it in our evolution environment for like 70 generations. And at a couple of different time points, I think at generation 10, 30, 50, and 70, in that we sequenced again. Okay, and so what we see is that the frequency of the evolved of each of these alleles in the evolved haploid changes. Okay, in this pool of haploid recombinants, each mutation in the evolved haploid should be present in an array of different genetic backgrounds. Okay, with and without all the other mutations in this evolved haploid. And so what we're doing when we do this selection is we're evolving this pool, and as we see the change in frequency of each of those mutations, that is the fitness effect of that mutation averaged across all possible genetic backgrounds involving the other mutations. Okay? So if we neglect any epistatic effects, it should be the same as the fitness effect of the mutation. Obviously, if there's some epistatic effects, we could have confounding factors here. Okay, yeah.
Roughly, so how many polymorphisms are in play here, and how big is the pool?
Well, so what we did, we took evolved clones from the end time points here of these four populations. So there are like, I don't know, of order 30, 40, that kind of number, mutations in these clones. And the pool is enormous. I don't remember the numbers, but these are like, you know, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 kind of number of spores. Okay? So here's what we see, all right? If you look at, this is an asexual population and this is a sexual population. And of course, when you do this, you miss a lot of things because, first of all, we're doing this on individual evolved clones. And so mutations, and in this data, we're just looking at the clones from the final time point. So these mutations, for instance, which eventually went extinct, are just not present in those clones that we took. And so we don't have an estimate of their fitness from this particular measurement. In addition, obviously, a lot of these things are just going to give you results that are not significantly different from zero, because this is a sequencing-based assay. It's, you know, dependent on the read depth, and you have to be able to track the frequencies over time, and so it's not the highest, as high resolution as one would like. But what we did was we, you know, got out the significant results that we could, and so all of the mutations where we have fitness effects that are significantly different from zero are indicated here and are shown in color here, okay? And in this top, this is the asexual population, and in the bottom, it's the sexual population. And in orange, we have things that are above zero, and in blue, things that are below zero. So these are deleterious mutations, these are beneficial mutations.
So we have asexual on the top?
Asexual on the top, and the top here, and these are the sexual ones, okay? And these are just in order from left to right of these, you know, mutations as we go across. Okay? So what you see, if we look at the asexual population first, is that, you know, you have these various fixation events, okay, that occur. And in each case, there is at least one beneficial mutation that is sweeping the fixation, okay, shown here in the orange. However, in most of the cases, you also have hitchhiking, substantially deleterious mutations here. Okay. And these mutations, they're less deleterious, obviously, than the beneficial ones are beneficial, but it's still a significant deleterious effect, on the order of 1 or a couple percent. Okay. So that, to me, was really kind of striking and surprising, that you got the fixation of these significantly deleterious mutations. In a few cases, just to verify the results of these, of this bulk segregant analysis, which is a little bit crude, these stars, we actually made direct reconstructions of these specific mutations on the ancestral background to verify the fitness effect. And in all cases, we found that the results, you know, were within the respective error bars of the bulk segregant analysis. So it checks out with reconstructions.
So how do you know the blue things are deleterious?
Well, what happens is, in the bulk segregant analysis that we did, if you look at the frequency of these alleles over time, they go, in other words, in doing this part, okay, you make this pool, and you look at
what you're showing on the next slide. That's the bulk.
No.
This is not bulk segregant analysis.
Well, this is data from the bulk segregant analysis. Sorry, this
you're going back to the original.
This is just the original figure that I showed you.
Okay. Sorry, I thought that this was the bulk segregant analysis.
Sorry. Yeah, this is the original figure. Good. Just to show you where these mutations fall on those trajectories that we saw a couple slides ago. Right.
So the deleterious mutations, are they non-synonymous?
Yes, in most cases they're non-synonymous, with the exception of this one, which is synonymous. Where is that? Oh, I can't tell which one it is. That's a problem. It's this one, I guess. Yeah, it's this one. It's some non-synonymous mutation in this. But in the other cases, this is intergenic. This. Okay. Okay. So in this, we have normally thought about the disadvantage of being asexual in terms of loss of beneficial mutations, which, you know, certainly happens, right? You know, these mutations, some of them must be beneficial, and some of them are getting lost. They're not being able to fix because of interference with, you know, this group of mutations. So, you know, that effect certainly does occur, but clearly, like, one of the things that's going on here in these asexual populations is you're getting the fixation of these deleterious mutations by hitchhiking, and that also is likely to play a role. Yeah, Mike.
That's exactly what is to be expected, right? That's what our and your work has shown.
No, it is
emergent neutrality, right? So.
I know, but
mutations,
so
mutations with a clerical deleterious effect behave in their fixation statistics as if they were merely neutral.
Yes, so that's right. However, you know, we spent some time before we did this you know, trying to make some estimates of, you know, how strongly deleterious mutations should fix and so on. And so, you know, in Ben and my paper from genetics, I guess it was last year now, on the deleterious passengers in adapting populations, and I think similar results come out of your framework. When we plugged in numbers that we thought at the sort of outer skirts of what's plausible, we could not really get a strong effect of deleterious mutations reducing the rate of adaptation in the asexual populations. Like, it just, obviously, our stuff, it's like going to be emergent neutrality. Sure, you're going to get some fixation and hitchhiking of deleterious mutations, but then it's a quantitative question of how strong this effect should be, and based on our estimates beforehand, which is actually maybe embarrassingly now discussed in the discussion of our paper, we came to the conclusion that this really shouldn't be a major effect in our experimental setting, okay, based on whatever estimates we can do. But obviously, there's something wrong with that calculation. Maybe there's something wrong with our estimates of what the distributions of fitness effects are, or something. Because we are getting this effect.
I don't really understand why something has to be wrong with that, from the fact that you observe deleterious mutations hitchhiking to fixation.
I'm not saying anything is wrong with the theory. I'm just saying that our a priori estimates of what the parameters were that led us to the conclusion that this effect should not be important in practice, some parameter estimate or something was off. I don't think it's maybe not that important. That's why we do experiments, obviously, but.
What's going on in that bottom sexual one?
Right, so let's look at
there's three deleterious guys taking off simultaneously.
Exactly, so, we have several deleterious mutations that happen early on here, right? They presumably hitchhike. You can't really see there's a other mutation here that eventually fixes. There are these mutations here. So presumably these are deleterious mutations that are initially hitchhiking, you know, within one or at most two of these asexual cycles, right? And they, you know, these beneficial mutations drag them up to high frequency, but then they get decoupled, right, through one and a couple sexual cycles, and they get driven to extinction, right? And so this purging of these deleterious mutations is allowing the sexual populations to adapt more efficiently.
Right? So it's not there were some epistatic effects when they were...
I mean, we can't rule out epistatic effects. Obviously, there might be some, but we don't need to invoke them here. Okay.
So it's recombination of finite strength, right? So for a while,
right,
it behaves.
Yeah, they,
as
90
in the
generations
upper feature,
they
but
behave.
Then...
Yeah, for 90 generations they behave purely asexually, and if you think about it, even after one sporulation cycle, you still have a lot of linkage, but after two, you should be more or less decoupled if they're on different chromosomes, which they typically are. Okay, and so you can see this in the mutations that arise and fix in these populations. So if we look at the asexual versus the sexual populations, if you just look at the sort of all the mutations that we observe, there's a fairly similar spectrum of non-synonymous, synonymous, and intergenic mutations in the sexual versus asexual populations, but you can really see a dramatic difference in which mutations fix, right? In the asexual populations, less mutations fixed than are observed, but there's not really much pruning, right? These relative ratios of these three are basically the same, and this is kind of like, once you reach detectable frequency, your selective effect no longer really matters much. This is kind of that emergent neutrality. We saw some signatures of that last time. Whereas in the sexual populations, obviously you see something totally different. Here, all the synonymous mutations and most of the intergenic mutations get purged, and also, of course, many of the non-synonymous mutations, and presumably you're now just more reliably fixing only the beneficial mutations.
Can you explain the emergent neutrality again? I thought that I was going to figure out what it was, but I'm not sure.
Well, so basically what we're referring to is the fact that maybe a good way of putting it is like this, all right? So can you see over here?
Yeah.
All right, so you know, remember last time I was talking about, okay, there's all this stuff going on in the population, and there's distribution of fitness present within the population. And then what's happening is that mutations that we observe, okay, that reach a detectable frequency here, okay, are mutations that somehow got way up above the mean fitness, okay, in order to expand in frequency. And so, you know, if we think about, you know, mutations that land somewhere out here in this front, there are two kinds of ways that you could land out here. You know, you could be basically a large effect mutation that occurs in a sort of average genetic background, okay? Or you could be a neutral or weakly beneficial or even slightly deleterious mutation that happens in an exceptionally lucky background. So imagine a deleterious mutation that happens in a very lucky background, okay? Now, obviously, it's unlikely for a mutation to happen in a very lucky background, okay, compared to an average background. But on the other hand, there are also many fewer strongly beneficial mutations than there are neutral or deleterious mutations. So there's a kind of balance between, okay, how common is the mutation that provides that effect versus what kind of background it needs to land on in order to get up here, okay? So you have this balance between these two factors that's determining what mutations land up here. And then the emergent neutrality is that essentially once you see a mutation in the population, you're already effectively conditioning on it having landed out here, somewhere out in the front, right? Okay? And at that point, it no longer matters whether it was one of these guys or one of these guys, right? All that matters is that it landed out here, right? And so the fitness effect of the mutation itself, conditional on it reaching some frequency that we can measure, is basically, it's not completely unimportant, but it's not that important, okay? And so, you know, the deleterious mutations are as likely to fix as the beneficial ones, not quite, but more likely to fix, you know, given that they land out here, okay? Now, what Michael means by emergent neutrality, it's like a little bit more subtle than that, right? Because we also have to think about, okay, the more strongly deleterious the mutation is, the less likely it is to land out here. So there's some balance, right? For weakly deleterious mutations, they're actually quite likely to wind up out here, okay? And so they can fix with nearly neutral probabilities, whereas strongly deleterious mutations still can't, okay? And as there's more and more stuff going on in the population, essentially, then that regime of effective neutrality kind of gets broader in a sense, all right?
The effective neutrality notion really makes sense if you come from a strong recombination limit and you're thinking of the fate of an allele being dependent on its own fitness contribution.
Right.
And the question which does not come up in the asexual case which you're explaining here, where you're selecting genotypes.
Right.
Whole genomes. You don't even know necessarily what to attribute to different mutations, right?
Yep.
And now you're saying, well, if you're somewhere in between and the fate of a particular allele also depends on the fate of the whole region that it's not had time to recombine and is traveling with it, then it may appear to you as if you are not selecting against effects that are larger than your nominal effective population size, or shall we say, census population size, and then you start saying, well, there is an effective population size which is smaller to accommodate this notion that selection effects are masked by something else happening on the genome.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess what we all agree is that emergent neutrality is not equivalent to just a reduction in effective population size.
It's we
not
already
uniform
had,
change.
Yeah. We already had this battle here.
Yeah. So the strongly beneficial ones behave with the census population size. So it's a non-uniform change.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Sorry if I'm beating.
I mean, there's some
horse.
Funny things that.
that horse can never be beaten.
There's some funny things that happen.
So this is all the same horse.
So this is like a little bit of a digression, right? It's actually a major digression, right? But there's some funny things that happen too. Like, for instance, if you look at the fixation probability of mutations as a function of S at this kind of dynamic steady state, right? That is actually always given by the Kimura formula with some NE, which can be defined. And, you know, the functional form is the Kimura formula with some NE, and obviously the NE is reduced by all the interference. But so, like, all of the drift barrier arguments that you would make, Michael, all hold and so on with a reduced effective population size, even in the presence of all this interference. And I don't think we really know why that works, but it does, right? Maybe you guys know why it works.
For a class of these processes, I think.
Yes, without epistasis and all this stuff, yeah.
Maybe.
Okay, anyway.
You go on.
All right. So right now we just have some kind of crappy data in diploids. So the diploid populations, I don't really quite know what to make of them yet. We have a few more of these now, but these were the first couple that we sequenced. So here's an asexual, these are the ones I showed you before. Here's an asexual and a sexual diploid population. And so, okay, first of all, in the asexual diploid, you see, you know, some mutations they accumulate, and they fix essentially as heterozygotes, which is unsurprising. In the sexual diploid population, this is a little bit more mysterious. So you have this mutation, which eventually fixes as a homozygote, which kind of makes sense in a sexual population. But here, for instance, you have these mutations which sort of seem to stabilize at roughly 50% frequency. So what the hell is going on there? Is this population really sexual? And I mean, the basic answer is we don't really know what to make of this yet. But it is interesting that we find at least one and possibly a couple of overdominance effects, which could, in principle, explain these two. And this is, unfortunately, from before I harmonized the colors. But these two mutations, one of them, they're these two things here. And certainly, at least this one has a relatively strong overdominant fitness effect.
Michael, but how about an elephant on those plots? Mm-hmm. Why are there so few traces?
Yeah, that's an elephant. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. You know, initially when I saw this, I just thought, you know, well, we're just crappy at calling mutations in diploids because obviously everything is half the density. But so then what we did was we took a bunch of these, we took some evolved clones, we sporulated them, and we sequenced the haploid offspring, and it checks out with this. I mean, there's a few more mutations like you would expect because there's some low-frequency private stuff, but, like, it's not like there are hundreds of mutations that we're missing here. So I don't know what's happening.
Are the mutations that you find in the haploids mostly loss of function? I mean, is this
mutations
maybe explain some of the differences?
Well, yeah. I mean, so a lot of the mutations in the haploid populations are presumably loss of function. So one thing to do, which would be interesting, which we haven't done yet, is we can take some of these mutations and make heterozygotes and look at their fitness effects. That's a kind of obvious thing to look at. And that's easy to do, at least relatively easy to do. But I don't know.
You're selecting for overdominant. You may be selecting for overdominant effects in the diploid population, and that just may be a smaller target zone of mutations.
So you're basically saying that the most of selective effects are loss of function. It's harder to lose function in diploid.
Yeah. In diploid, you're not going to be selecting.
Assuming that those are recessive, which is maybe a reasonable assumption, okay. then yeah.
But there's no reason an overdominant situation has to lead to 0.5 either, right?
No, I know.
It's just by chance.
That's right. And the thing is, right, this ought to actually have lead to a significant cost of sex, right? I mean, because you're making all these unfit homozygotes in the sexual population, whereas in the asexual population, you don't have that problem. Yet we do see that these populations are more fit than those ones. So I don't know what to make of it, really.
But this is amazing, right? This is the biggest effect of all, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's so many fewer mutations. There's still similar sorts of fitness gains, okay? A little bit less in the diploids, but not dramatically so. There are these overdominance effects, which should lead to costs in the sexual populations, but in fact, you see that the sexual populations adapt more rapidly. So, I mean, we are, I have sequence data actually off the sequencer for more of these things, and we're processing it now. But this is what we have so far.
I'm lost by this. If there were recessive mutations in the diploid, they'd do better than they do in the haploid, because they wouldn't. There would be deleterious in the haploid.
No, we're talking about recessive beneficial mutations. So the hypothesis is that a lot of the mutations that are beneficial in the haploids are loss of function. So these are would be recessive beneficial mutations, would be the natural guess anyway. So then they just couldn't really get anywhere in the diploids because they occur, of course, first as heterozygotes.
Is there any evidence that diploids are actually just resistant at the single base level to changes, or is there gene conversion? Is it some sort of thing like that, whether it's a part repair pathways?
I don't know. I mean, so we're doing some fluctuation assays now just to test like mutation rate things. We don't see any dramatic differences as far as I can tell. I mean, of course, those things are like just at a few loci, and so. But I don't think people have reported big differences in mutation rates. Are you aware of any of
them? No, that's why it's such a surprise.
Yeah, so I have no idea what's going on there. But we have done, I mean, in the more sequencing we've done another half a dozen of these. And it's certainly, I mean, the data is not even at this low level of quality yet, and so I'm not showing it. But it is certainly true that there's also very few mutations in those, okay, compared to this. So it's not just these two. All the ones we've sequenced have many, many fewer mutations. Okay. In practice, what's going to happen, just fair warning, is that we're not going to work all of this out because the postdoc, Mike, who's working on this, needs to go back to New Zealand and we'll see. But that's where we are right now, and we'll get as much done on it in the next year as we can. All right, so I want to shift gears now and talk about the last part, which I just briefly alluded to also last time, which is about characterizing statistical patterns of epistasis between mutations. And so like I mentioned last time, there's been a lot of work on this, which basically takes the perspective of looking at a few mutations that accumulate in a specific evolved population, making all possible combinations of these mutations, measuring their fitness, and looking at how the fitness effect of individual mutations varies across different backgrounds. Here are a few representative papers, but there are many more. And the basic conclusion of all these studies is that there's lots of epistasis. Okay? But as I mentioned before, okay, this is not the same thing as saying that epistasis really constrains adaptation a lot. And so I want to draw this distinction between what I would like to call microscopic versus macroscopic epistasis. And so the idea here is the question that we really want to ask is how does one mutation change, the prospects for future evolution of a given lineage? And so the way we can think of that is in terms of how a single mutation changes the distribution of fitness effects for future mutations. So I can draw one scenario here, right? Imagine that we have this distribution of fitness effects of beneficial mutations, where strongly beneficial mutations are less common than weakly beneficial ones. Okay, and here are just a few mutations which I'm highlighting for the purpose of illustration. And imagine this gray mutation happens, all right? What could happen is that the distribution of fitness effects doesn't change very much at all. And this is kind of the natural expectation, at least for most people. You get one mutation, it's not going to really change the spectrum of everything that could happen. And that might be true even if individual mutations change their fitness effect by a lot. So here I'm drawing this mutation was nearly neutral before, and this was strongly beneficial. And this gray mutation happens, and these things just kind of switch around. All right. And so now, after this gray mutation, maybe this black mutation would happen next. And if you were to do this kind of reconstruction experiment, what you would conclude is that along the line of descent, you're getting mutations that have substantial epistatic interactions because, this black mutation would not be beneficial on the ancestral background but would be beneficial on the background in which it would occur, and you would come to the conclusion that epistasis was super important, when in reality, in some sense, it isn't. Okay? Alternatively, we could imagine that you make a single mutation and it totally changes the distribution of fitness effects of what can happen. And in this case, you can really have historical contingency such that the first mutations that you get really shape the future evolutionary trajectory. So here you can get historical contingency at the genotype level, but not at the fitness level. But here you can get it at different levels. Okay? So that's what we want to look for. So what I'm going to do is tell you first about some published work on this, which was a project led by Sergei Krasimsky. And then I'll go through this as quickly as I reasonably can, and then I'll talk about some more recent data from experiments that are ongoing right now that address a similar question and address the same question in a somewhat different context. All right. So the thing we wanted to do, okay, was ask this question whether this kind of macroscopic epistasis exists. And so to do that, what we did, okay, Sergei isolated a single clone of yeast, which I'm going to call Dibank, okay, just some ancestral clone. And then what we did was we made about, I forget the number, 532, I think, independent populations started from this identical clone. I'm just showing a 7 or so here. And we allowed them to evolve in our evolution environment. And we did so at 2 different population sizes, a reasonably large and a very small population size. So we just allow them to accumulate mutations for 250 generations here. Okay? We took these 500 and some populations and we isolated a single clone from each of them. And we measured the fitness of that clone. And from that large set, we chose 64, I'm just showing 7 here, but 64 clones, each from an independently evolved population here, and we call those the founding genotypes. Okay. So these differ from each other, as we'll see in a few minutes, by, of order 5 mutations, because there's, a few mutations that occur on each of these branches, so 2 clones will differ from each other by about a half a dozen mutations or so. Okay. And these are these founding genotypes. And then we want to ask, do those first mutations you got affect what you can do in the future? And so to do that, okay, what we did is from each of these clones, we founded a bunch of replicate populations. In fact, 10 replicate populations from each of the 64 founding genotypes, so a total of 640 lines here. I'm just showing 3 here. And the reason for this design is what we want to do is compare the variation in outcomes between lines founded from the same founding genotype, which just tells you about, how inherently random the evolution is, versus variation between these groups, right? And if there's variation between this group and this group above and beyond the variation within groups, then that's telling you that the identity of this founding genotype is affecting something about how these populations are evolving, right? That's the idea. Okay. And so the first thing that we did, okay, was just quantify this by looking at all of the variance in how much these populations adapt during this, I should have said, 500 generations of adaptation here. And what we find is that if you look at the variation between all those 640 lines, half of that variance can be explained if you just know the identity of the founding genotype. Okay. And there's effect, roughly a third due to just evolutionary stochasticity, and 20% or so is just measurement error. Okay. So there's a big effect of the founding genotype, all right? But that this has a really simple explanation, okay? If you take these 640 founding genotypes and arrange them by their fitness, okay, where 0 here is that original ancestor, and we look at how at the final fitness of all of the descendant lines, okay, after 250 or 500 generations of the adaptation phase, right, what we see is, okay, that the lines that started at low fitness, okay, they increased in fitness. This horizontal line is line of equal initial and final fitness. So these guys increased in fitness by quite a bit. Here, these points are the average fitness of the 10 lines descended from that founder, and these error bars reflect the variation between the 10 replicate lines. So this measures sort of how much evolutionary stochasticity there is, and this is the average adaptation. And you can see the guys that started at high fitness, on the other hand, barely adapted at all. Right? So basically, if I give you the fitness effect of the fitness of the founder genotype, that can predict almost all of this effect of the founder identity. Okay, there is a small but statistically significant effect of the founder genotype above and beyond fitness. So, for example, If we look at, where is it? These guys here, I believe, right? So here are a couple, here are a couple of founders that are at roughly the same fitness, but they sort of, one reproducibly adapts faster than the other, and you know, you can repeat these things. So there are some small effects of genotype other than fitness, but essentially the fitness explains everything here. Okay. So there are a few sort of explanations of why this could be. So the one and sort of most boring and maybe obvious explanation is just that there are only a few things that these populations can do, right? Imagine that there's like a half a dozen mutations that you can get to increase in fitness in a given environment. And so the high fitness genotypes then adapt more slowly because, you know, these guys are at high fitness because they've already done all those things, so there's just not much left for them to do, and these guys, they can't, right? So we could imagine that as one possible explanation. Or alternatively, there could be some sort of general diminishing returns epistasis, such that mutations provide smaller fitness advantages in these backgrounds that are at high fitness, right? And this really only has to be true on average, okay? There could be lots of complicated epistatic interactions between individual mutations, or it could be true sort of just generally, right? And obviously these things are not mutually exclusive, right? To some extent, this must be happening at some level, right? These guys are more fit, there must be somehow less for them to do. But the question we wanted to ask was sort of which of these kinds of things can which of these effects most explains this result that we had. And so one of the things we wanted to do to look at this was just look at the genetic basis of this adaptation. So we took 13 of these founders and sequenced all 130 descendant lines, and a few of them dropped out for various technical reasons, but we got over 100 sequenced lines in the end. And so we identified the mutations that happened here and then the mutations that happened here, right? And so the idea here is to ask, how does the founding genotype affect the adaptation in terms of which mutations are accumulating on these various branches, right? And so here's what we see. Okay, so first of all, there is no tendency for lines descended from high fitness founders. These are all the number of mutations, which I'm going to call putatively functional mutations, which I'll talk about what that means in a second. In lines, the average number of these mutations in each of the 10 lines descended from each of these different 13 founder genotypes arranged from the least fit founder here to the most fit founder here. And you can see that basically these guys all, on average, get roughly the same number of mutations in the descendant lines. So there is no tendency for lines descended from the high fitness founders in particular to get fewer mutations than the lines descended from the low fitness founders, as you would expect in this modular model. Now, of course, there's a lot of noise in here because we don't know. There's some neutral mutations, there's some deleterious mutations as well, and that's creating some noise here. So we looked at this in a whole bunch of different ways. We looked at all the mutations that are sort of repeated targets of adaptation across this experiment, across other experiments. We looked at all non-synonymous mutations, et cetera. And the bottom line is that we could find no relationship in any way that we looked at it between the founder fitness and the number of mutations that you get. It's just flat as far as we can tell. So I guess the best way to put this is that there is no evidence that we can come up with that this modular epistasis model describes it. Yeah.
Mike, I'm assuming these are in haploids, is it?
Yes. Yeah, these are all in haploids. Yeah. Okay. And we can also look at the identity of these mutations. So these are the same founder genotypes again. These are the mutations in the non-synonymous mutations in the founder genotypes themselves. And then these are all the mutations in genes which are mutated at least three or more times across this experiment in all of the 10 descendant lines. Okay, so you can see, for instance, you know, in the lines, 10 lines descended from this founder genotype, you know, a couple of them got mutations in SIR2 and so on. You can look at that, right? And the basic message here is that this is sort of a generally, like, there's no clustering at all that you can find in this data, at least that we were able to find in this data. It just looks like kind of a mess. which is suggesting that basically all or many of these mutations are beneficial in at least many of these genetic backgrounds. I mean, obviously there's not power to really say, you know, comprehensively, but there's no evidence that any of these mutations are beneficial only in the high or only in the low fitness background, right? Everything is sort of more or less scattered as evenly as they can be scattered across this. Okay, so it seems like we have a relatively large pool of potentially beneficial mutations, which are beneficial in many, at least many of the genetic backgrounds. Okay. And so that leads us to ask, okay, what is actually causing this diminishing returns, and suggests in favor of this sort of global pattern of diminishing returns epistasis. So to get some more direct evidence for that, we chose three particular mutations. These are loss of function mutations. These are three of the ones that you see here, including the ones that show the sort of strongest constraints. So this GAT2 in particular is a mutation that was observed three times and only in descendants of this particular founding genotype. So if there's any mutation that has some idiosyncratic effect, you know, this is the one for which there's the strongest evidence. Right? And here are a couple more. And this HO was a negative control. This HO has a loss of function mutation in our ancestor. And so what we did was we reconstructed these mutations in all 13 of these founding genotypes, as well as the divergence ancestor and a few other genotypes. And what we see is systematically, if you look at the fitness effect of these reconstructed mutations as a function of the fitness of the genotype in which we reconstruct them, we see this diminishing returns pattern. So it appears that at least for these mutations, there is this sort of systematic diminishing returns pattern. And so what that suggests is that sort of this overall pattern of diminishing returns, which is leading to convergent evolution in terms of fitness, is due to this global diminishing returns, which means that, you know, they can, all these populations are sort of going in all different directions in terms of the mutations that they're acquiring, but they're sort of reaching this plateau of fitness, okay, roughly, you know, out here at about 8% fitter than this ancestor, and that diminishing returns is leading to this convergence. So that stuff that's a little bit old is published now. And there's a million criticisms that you could make of this. And so one of the criticisms that you could say is that, okay, this is some diminishing returns pattern among a set of strains that it's divergent from some ancestor by a relatively small amount. Okay, it is a sort of relevant thing when thinking about contingency because, you know, it's asking whether the first few steps of some trajectory can affect the future. But one might ask whether the similar kind of pattern holds over much, much larger evolutionary scales. And so this is some of the new work the last thing I want to tell you guys about. So in order to address this, basically, we can do the exact same kind of experiment, but basically make these founding genotypes in entirely different ways. And there's a few different ways that we're doing this. The one I want to tell you about is something that a grad student in my lab, Elizabeth, is working on, also has worked on this with Sergey. And the basic idea is to take this panel of strains that was created by Leonid Prugliak's group, as described in this paper, where what they did is they took a lab strain of yeast and a wild strain of yeast called RM, mated and sporulated, and created a pool of 1,000 haploid offspring of this cross. And these guys differ by an order of 50,000 mutations. So these offspring, right, they differ from each other by about 50,000 or so mutations. And they sequenced all of these 1,000 offspring. Okay? So we have this panel of 1,000 different potential founding genotypes that differ from each other by 50,000 or so mutations, which are at least to some extent representative of natural variation in yeast. And we took basically the MAT-A haploid recombinants, and we took a pool of about half of the existing ones. So there's about 250 founding genotypes that we chose, basically, out of this. To span a range of fitness relative to each other in this case. All right? And so we did exactly the same thing, I should just say. We did exactly the same thing. These are our founding genotypes. We founded half a dozen replicate lines from each. We evolved them forward, and we looked at how they adapted. In addition to looking at adaptation, this is in our sort of rich media. When I say low temperature, I mean the sort of standard yeast evolution temperature, 30 degrees. And here is we did the exact same experiment in a second environment just to look at whether the specific conditions would matter. And we see a high, so this is at 37 degrees in a defined media called SC. And in both cases, what we see is the same exact pattern of diminishing returns. I plotted it a little differently here. Here's the initial fitness of the founding genotype, now one of these segregants. Here is the change in fitness in that environment after 500 generations of adaptation in that environment. And again, these error bars are the variation between replicate evolutions started from that same founding genotype. And again, you see this diminishing returns in both cases. So this same sort of general pattern holds over much, much larger evolutionary timescales. There are some more things we can say, though, from this, which are a little different than the previous case. So one of the nice things about this panel of strains is it's designed for mapping phenotypes, right? So you have what the Krugliak lab has done with these things is, you know, you measure some phenotype, you have all of these different segregants that have different alleles at all these loci, and you map the allele to, you know, the QTLs to the phenotype. Here, the phenotype is how much you adapt in each of these environments, and so we can try to do the same kind of mapping. It's a little bit tricky because obviously the initial fitness of the segregant matters. So when you do this QTL mapping, of course, you pull out all of the things that affect fitness in both of the environments. They also affect how much you adapt. But we do find at least one and actually probably several other QTLs that affect the adaptability above and beyond fitness. It's not clear really quite how much we can make of these because they all also do affect fitness. But here's the most striking example. This is an allele at a gene called CRE33, which is involved in the small ribosomal subunit. And one allele of this CRE33, I mean, it obviously has a fitness effect, but even above and beyond the fitness effect, it appears that the guys with this orange allele adapt more rapidly given the same initial fitness than guys with the green allele. Okay. So again, we did some sequencing of these populations, 230 evolved lines descended from, I forget how many, 100 or so of these, not 100, 40 or so, 48, I think, I forget, of these founding genotypes. And so, okay, we find some of the mutations. Again, we see, you know, lots of non-synonymous. There's some synonymous and some other types of mutations. And here, in contrast to what we saw before, there is actually some relationship between the initial fitness of the founder genotype that we look at and the number of mutations you get. So there is some effect of this sort of modular epistasis that we couldn't find any effect of before. And if you look at the mutations involved, okay, so these are, again, all of the genes in which we saw mutations in at least three replicate populations. So you can see a couple of modules that are particularly strongly mutated. Ribosome biogenesis, regulators of RAS, typically negative regulators of RAS, get loss of function mutations. There's a whole bunch of other stuff, like these SIR genes, for instance, that you see particularly in the high temperature adaptation. And if we go back to this QTL that I mentioned a moment ago, we see that there's actually a big effect of the identity of this QTL on the future fitness. So if you look, okay, here, each row is an evolved line. Each row is an evolved line. And these are lines evolved at 37, 30, 37, and 30. And these lines here at the top have one allele at CRE33, the more fit allele. And these guys have the less fit allele at CRE33. And so you can obviously see that guys that didn't have this mutation get a mutation at CRE33 or get some mutation in other aspects of this small ribosomal subunit. More or less, you get one of these things. Although there are cases where you know, in a few cases, you do get a couple. Okay. And then there are these negative regulators of RAS. So IRA1 and IRA2 you get in all these different backgrounds. These other negative, these other regulators of RAS, you only see with this given allele at Cre33 and not with this one. And then there's a bunch of other stuff that we see, you know, occasionally. All right. So we're still sort of trying to figure out exactly what's going on here, but it seems like in this case, we still have this general diminishing returns, but there also clearly appears to be some, you know, specific idiosyncratic loci that are affecting the adaptation. So the last thing I want to say, and maybe some of you guys can help me figure out like how to ask these questions a little better. So one additional last thing that we wanted to ask with this data is, how does adaptation to one of these conditions affect your fitness in the other condition? So for instance, if you take a line and you evolve it in high temperature, what is the fitness trade-off that you observe at low temperature, and what does that depend on? So the question we want to ask is essentially, you know, here's the initial fitness of all these founding 250 founding genotypes at the low temperature environment, and here's the initial fitness in the high temperature environment. And they're correlated, which is probably unsurprising. But there's a lot of spread around this correlation. So for example, if we look at all of these initial founding genotypes that have more or less the same fitness at low temperature, but different fitnesses at high temperature, would you expect them, if you evolve them at low temperature, would you expect to see any differences in the trade-offs that they experience at high temperature? Okay. Or not? Okay. And if so, what would those differences be? And similarly, you can ask a sort of reverse question. If we look at all strains that have the same fitness at high temperature, but different fitnesses at low temperature, you evolve them at low temperature, what would their trade-offs be at high temperature? Okay. And so, you know, one hypothesis that I had was that if you start with these guys at the same fitness at low temperature, but different fitness at high temperature, they'll evolve about the same at low temperature. We know that. But my guess was that these lines that started at high fitness at the high temperature would have a more strongly negative trade-off at the high temperature than these guys. Okay. And conversely, if you have lines that start that are all the same fitness at high temperature, but different fitnesses at low temperature, these guys over here are going to adapt more at low temperature than these guys. Sorry, other way around. These guys are going to adapt more at low temperature than these guys. But my prediction would be that they would all have roughly the same trade-off at the high temperature. Okay. And so we try to look at this, and we see that in one of the conditions, that appears to be true. If you look at lines, I'm sorry, this is sort of inconsistent notation. These are lines that are evolved at the high temperature here in this column. And if you look at their initial fitness, and these are the low temperature. If you look at their initial fitness in low temperature, this predicts the fitness increment at low temperature. And you can show that basically adding the fitness, initial fitness at this high temperature does not significantly improve this regression. And you know, you get the opposite, and this is the unsurprising thing, of course, that we've sort of seen before. The initial fitness at this high temperature predicts that adaptation. But in the other condition, that doesn't appear to be true. So if you look at things evolved at the low temperature, actually, the initial fitness at the low temperature predicts the trade-off at the high temperature, and adding in what you know about the fitness at the high temperature doesn't really improve that prediction. So I'm not really quite sure what to make of that yet. But I don't know if anybody has any ideas on how to. You know, this is a little bit of a confusing question for me to ask. So if anybody has any ideas on that, I'd love to hear them. And so that's it. I think I'll just skip over these conclusions because you've heard me talk enough. And I just want to emphasize again the folks that did all this work. So this epistasis and pleiotropy things were done by Elizabeth and Sergey here. Mike did the experiments on the sexual populations. You heard about Ben's work yesterday. A bunch of other folks in the lab have done other things. There's a bunch of lineage tracking things, which I mentioned yesterday, for instance, that are being led by Alex and Jose, and maybe in a year's time I'll talk about them.
One question. I know you explained this, but I'm just having trouble reproducing it in my head. You kept seeing the diminishing returns,
yeah.
And we're surprised by it, but I'm a little bit puzzled about what you would actually expect to see other than that. So, because, you know, given what you showed with the E. coli, it fits that kind of...
Right. Yeah, that's right. You know, I think people had the... Right. It's always dangerous to tell people what they should be surprised by, so I won't attempt to do that. But
well, why were you surprised?
Well, two reasons. So first of all, I guess I always had this sort of traditional picture in mind of, you know, populations sort of climbing fitness hills or something like that, which I think is a sort of impression that many people had in mind. And I sort of had this impression that, you know, what you're doing, you have this large pool of potentially beneficial mutations, and of course, you know, you get the biggest ones first, and then you get smaller and smaller ones, and eventually, you know, you reach some dynamic steady state, whatever we can, that's another issue, but that, you know, you don't need epistasis to explain the slowdown in adaptation as the population has evolved for a long time. And, you know, most people's picture of this fitness peak or something is sort of consistent with that. Here, what you're seeing is what appears to be a very large number of beneficial mutations, all of which are relatively strongly beneficial on the ancestral background, like at least dozens of these mutations. And yet, any four or five of them is enough, right? And that, to me, is a little weird, right? It's sort of like there's not like a single peak in terms of genotype space that this is where you want to go in genotype space, okay? Rather, there's like a lot of different things that you can do, and it's not like there are four or five different types of things you can do, okay? Although, I mean, the stuff with these Kugliak lines, there are some signatures of that effect too, but in our original stuff, it's not like there are just four or five different types of things and you do one of each. It seems like there's like dozens of things you can do. They're all beneficial in the ancestral background. None of them that we can detect have this sort of, you know, you do one and then it's no longer beneficial to do it. They're sort of uniformly less beneficial as you get more fit. And yet, like, by the time you do four or five of them, you've really dramatically reduced the fitness effect of any one of them. I mean, that to me was surprising. The other thing that was sort of surprising is, so when some of these earlier papers came out that showed some diminishing returns along the line of descent, and a few things, I had the same reaction. I was like, well, it's just, of course you're going to have diminishing returns. And then you start like thinking about models that could explain this, like, in, I don't know, people have written a lot about this. And it's actually kind of hard to get sort of generic diminishing returns out of, you know, simple models. I mean, I don't know. Let me put it this way. Some people have tried to do this, you know, folks like Tony Dean and Seth Murray and you know, Bruce Levin and so on, and these kinds of, you know, simple models of pathways and so on. You know, I'm not saying it's not doable, but you didn't look in the literature and there were like tons of generic explanations for why you should get this diminishing return. So, you know, there must be some explanation, so I'm sure that somebody can come up with one, but it wasn't obvious. Yeah.
I completely agree with what you said. It's hard to guess what should be surprised and what not.
Yes.
But from this, if you have dozens of things that,
yeah,
you know, have a 1 or 2% fitness,
yeah,
advantage, it's sort of clear if they were not diminishing return globally.
Yeah.
You could just add them up and cut the generation time of this thing in half.
Yeah.
And that sounds,
right,
a hard thing.
Yes.
So in some sense,
Right, I agree. Given that there are lots of things that are beneficial, then this almost has to be true. But that, you know, it certainly could be the case, and at least my natural intuition before was that, you know, there might, that there just wouldn't be dozens of independent things you could do.
Yeah.
That the solution to that problem would just be, there's really only like five things you can do. Yeah, and then there's some tinkering, obviously, but that does not seem to be what's going on, so, I mean, yeah.
So why were they bad in the first place? I mean, they must have been in some other situation where those mutations were not bad. I mean, they're only bad because of your condition, right?
So there's a lot of stories you can tell about this. So, you know, the story that we're sort of, that I'm most fond of is basically, I think Andrew Murray coined this idea, that basically what is happening in these experiments is that the yeast are learning to trust us. And that basically, like in the natural history of yeast, it has paid yeast to be really pessimistic. You know, if the conditions are getting bad, it's likely that they're about to get much worse. And so you hunker down, stress response, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, in these experiments, you know, if things are getting bad, it means, you know, the graduate student will come again soon and conditions are going to get good. And that's kind of weird. And so, you know, some of the stuff, much of the stuff that you see in these experiments can certainly be explained in that context, like these negative regulators of RAS, obviously. The stress, you know, you get knockouts of various stress response, which is presumably just sort of telling the yeast, okay, like, we don't have to worry about stress response. There are other things as well, obviously, you know, there's stuff in cell wall biogenesis and so on, because presumably you got to build cell walls more rapidly and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, obviously you can and at some level should sort of try to figure out these stories.
I don't understand the logic of these stories and what they're supposed to convince us of. So, indeed, the yeast is adapting to some novel situation,
right,
which happens to be a very regular, reliable feeder.
Yeah.
But it's just adaptation. To a novel situation, it could be adaptation to. So, is there somehow a statement that because there's a graduate student involved, there's something very, very non-generic about this adaptive task as opposed to any other random adaptive task? I mean, what clearly is generic, it might be said, is, or rather non-generic, is that that particular case is making life easier rather than more complex, so that shedding a lot of genome dedicated to making this and that is going to help.
I mean, I guess a way of putting it would be just that, you know, this is one particular type of adaptive challenge that might, in some sense, be argued to be an outlier. And whether you believe that or not, I mean,
well,
I don't know. I don't want to take a position.
An outlier, but what kind of an outlier? So I think that the statement would be that this is an easy evolutionary task,
right,
as opposed to.
Let me just tell you.
Dealing with
virus,
dealing with a pathogen. Let me also.
But I'm sort of trying to get there, right? But I'm just trying to nail what is it, why do we think that this is special, right?
Because graduate students are responsible.
So well, not because graduate students are responsible, but because we have this notion that this is an easy solution, right? This is a situation where we're making adaptation relatively easy, as opposed to what Shelley Copley was talking about here, where you introduce the only source of nitrogen, some godforsaken molecule that the bug has never seen, and then it has to co-opt the bits and pieces of enzymatic pathways and build the whole metabolic pathway. And even that can be done in 500 generations, right? But so what's the...
Well, I mean, you know, basically, you know, my argument would be similar to yours, but I'm sort of, you know, trying to be fair, like people who criticize these sort of results, which, I mean, I don't think is unreasonable, which is just that, you know, this might be special. I mean, we could argue about why it's not necessarily
I'm
special.
I'm basically saying that it's not a terribly good criticism because everything's special. What's special? We have to define some sort of ensemble of things,
right,
and we don't know what it is.
Exactly. So, I mean, let me just answer this also further by just mentioning one other experiment that we're doing, which gets, at least in some slightly different way, at this sort of criticism, which is, you know, these founding genotypes, like I said, we can find them in various ways. So, one thing which we're trying to do, we made a big panel of single gene deletions in yeast, right? So that span a bunch of different pathways that we know about. We have several representatives of each pathway. So, you know, you've got like a bunch of deletions in genes in this pathway, that pathway, and so on, attempting as best we can to sort of span like something we know about yeast. Same experiment that you've heard before, we look at that. So you make all these deletions, you look at the adaptation, okay? Then the cool thing about this is because, so you can ask the same question, okay? And I don't know that the answer is yet, but my guess is we're going to find diminishing returns again. But then we can actually ask a little bit more sophisticated questions there, because then there are two things that we can do going forward. So with those deletions, you can then put back the gene that you deleted, okay? And ask basically how much of this adaptation was only adaptive because of the background of the deletion and how much of it was generically adaptive, right? So you're looking at like how much of it is really compensatory versus not. And then what you can do, so you know, we take these, like we've got, I forget the exact number, about 40 or so knockouts that we managed to make and evolve so far. So then we're gonna have whatever. We have 20 replicates out of each, so we'll have like 800 lines. We'll put the ancestral gene back in each of those 800. And then what you can do is for each of those, actually, you can create a barcoded library of things to knock out all of the genes that you started with knockouts of. So we can take, like, gene number 7, knockout, evolved in the presence of the absence of gene number 7, put gene number 7 back in, and now make a library of guys that are knocked out for all of the genes, right? And look at what the fitness effect is in all those other genetic backgrounds. So then you can ask, okay, to what extent were the mutations that occurred here, you know, what were their interactions with all the other kinds of backgrounds that you have? And so there we can say something hopefully like more mechanistic about what's going on with the epistasis. And I don't think it addresses the, it would still be in like a single rich media condition, which is special in the sense that, you know, we were just talking about, but one way to then address that is, okay, then you're sort of trying to say something about the specific genes involved and the mechanisms. You know, the other thing that you could do, obviously, is try to define various environments that are special in different ways, right, and survey that, right?
So here's an experiment for your next grant proposal, I guess. So you have all these parallel evolution lines, right? And they're all more or less being selected the same way. But they're short-term experiments, and you're mutation limited, I think, in terms of what fixes anyhow. Have you thought about now taking the adaptive lines and crossing them and then moving on to the next step? You know, you just restart the whole experiment. Okay, have an orgy for a while and then just start another set of lines. And
yeah, I mean, we have a million of these.
There's these old ideas in animal breeding that go back a century, but you couldn't really do this back in those days because there were no molecular markers or anything.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, we're working on doing exactly those kinds of things. Many of the lines that we have are not really appropriate for this, just because, you know, when you do this, you want to do this in a system that's set up genetically to make this really as easy as possible. And so the system to do it in is a system with this Mike's crossing thing. So like you might want to take a bunch of the asexual controls and do these kinds of things. And it's definitely on the agenda. We've sort of done it already by, we're doing a whole separate set of experiments where we start with lines with lots of standing variation, kind of you know, to go back to like these old things that people have done in Drosophila and like crossing regularly and looking at, and so those are the lines now that, that are evolved and they have all the genetics that we want, and so we have in mind doing stuff like you're describing.
I have a little philosophical uneasiness here. And, so you're looking for this generic description of, so statistical description of epistasis. So very, very sympathetic with that. Right? But there are sort of two issues, right? So one is you can think of epistasis as a molecular geneticist, right?
Yes.
So, you know, you put in one mutation, put another mutation, and see what happens, whatever, in four cases, right? And with generic things, you're going to probably find, you know, a lot of epistasis where you think you'll find epistasis.
Right.
Where, you know, some pathways, things happen in the same pathway,
exactly.
And if you see it when it doesn't,
and maybe it tells
seem
you
to
about
be in the same pathway, then you'll probably discover that there's some connection between the pathways
right.
that you didn't know yeah. from reading a book, right? So, which is entirely expected.
Yeah. This is basically how we do genetics, right?
That's right. So that's the, you know, this molecular genetics view of epistasis, which makes us all think that there should be a lot of it. Then there is another thing, which is if you have, you know, a breeding population with some distribution of alleles and the haplotypes and whatnot, how much epistasis is there left in that breeding population? Right? And there are all sorts of reasons why in that population you may have bred it out.
Yes.
So now if you take two populations that haven't been breeding, or you made them artificially in Krugelich's lab, and you cross them, you're neither here nor there, right?
Yeah.
This is not a natural situation.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not, so, and then the devil is all in details. And it's easier now for me to sit here and criticize you, but the question is, how does one deal with this conundrum, right?
Well, I guess I don't see it like.
That
I agree with everything you're saying, and I don't see it as a conundrum or a criticism. I mean, I guess that's like a good way to handle criticism.
Then we go back to.
I mean.
Yeah, but I agree. But make the discussion less fun.
No, but okay. So here's. I mean, I guess here's what I think. Right? There's. You know, there's a lot of epistasis, you know, among sort of artificial constructs that we can create that geneticists work with all the time as a way to figure out how yeast work or how whatever you're looking at works. And that's fine. And, you know, I mean, that's how genetics works. Okay. There's the other sort of question which you're getting at, which is, you know, obviously, like the evolutionary history of any population is going to determine, you know, it's going to select on the epistatic interactions themselves, right? And you're not going to sort of, you know, if you imagine some weird ass fitness landscape, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean, like you are not going to wind up evolving into portions of that landscape which have, you know, average epistatic properties, right? Like somehow you're selecting on the epistatic interactions that are available and possible, right? And so, I mean, I guess, like, to some extent, what I'm trying to do with these kinds of experiments is two distinct kinds of things which are not really ultimately related to one another, one of which is to just look at what kinds of epistasis that we have and maybe try to understand or interpret it in terms of the physiology, which is, like, in terms of, you know, what we know from genetics as to why you have these patterns. But then there's the other question of, you know, just knowing what kinds of patterns we observe in different kinds of crosses like this, you know, in lines descended from a given evolved, you know, given ancestor, or in these kinds of artificial crosses, which are presumably rare, but also presumably do happen in the wild from time to time. And, you know, what the differences are and so on, somehow should tell us about how selection has acted or can act to shape those patterns of epistasis. But I just don't think like there's really much theory which describes like how evolution should act on. I mean, it's sort of a hard question.
But the issue here is, as you say, so selection on or against epistasis in breeding population, right?
Right.
And you can imagine this is something that we can address theoretically, we can address experimentally.
Yes.
But when you sort of study the distribution of interactions in some very nice, convenient setup,
yeah,
at the very least, right, you want to think very carefully and acknowledge very well how much the findings depend on the starting point. So speaking of, right?
And one can imagine, yes, I totally agree. One can imagine like doing additional things. Like, I mean, one experiment which we're doing is, you know, we take this cross, okay? You take these founding genotypes, okay? And then you can evolve them, you know, asexually, you can evolve them with continued crossing. Okay, so these are additional experiments that are ongoing. We're through about 720 generations now, where we, you know, cross them every 40 generations or every 90 generations or every 140 generations. And so, you know, you're sorting on all kinds of epistatic interactions. Then one can imagine like asking, okay, if you take evolved strains from that, like, do they have different, you know, systematically different kinds of epistasis than the things that you started with because of the way that they've been evolving, right? To sort on the right kinds of epistatic interactions. I mean, there are a million things that you could think of doing experimentally along these lines. There's a million models you can imagine writing down. And anyway, I'm totally open to any suggestions on either of those. I mean, especially the experiments. It's just like, I guess I'm like super interested in this. I just really have trouble crystallizing the question quite as well as I would like to do, because I mean, it's easy to think of 100 experiments. It's harder to think of two.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cool.